Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Canceler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Canceler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler, featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much.
Now, how free are you? How free could you be? How free do you really want to be? As free as a bird? Well, how about this bird?
I wish I could fly way up to the sky, but I can't.
You can?
I can't. I wish I could see what folks see in me, but I can't.
You can?
I can't.
Keith Harris and Orville debating the limits of freedom and happiness. But hang on, you're saying, in what sense can Orville enjoy freedom, exercise free will? Orville is a puppet, a slave to the fist of Keith Harris. But as you're going to hear, in this very state, the puppet may enjoy a kind of freedom that humans envy. It's the starting point of a remarkable new book that also considers the human sacrifices of the Aztecs, religious Gnosticism and its secular equivalent, and the social and political consequences of CCTV and social media. The Soul of the Marionette is the work of the political philosopher John Gray, the author of Straw Dogs, in which he argued for the essential meaninglessness of human existence. For Gray, progress is a story we tell to make us feel good about ourselves. And ourselves, well, they're a fiction too. Gray's new book begins with a moment from a story by Heinrich von Kleist, the German poet who took his own life at the age of 34. Kleist's narrator is watching a puppet show, and the figures in the performance strike him as having an advantage over their flesh-and-blood masters. They're liberated from the tyranny of choice. When I talked to John Gray earlier, I asked him to describe Kleist's thought processes.
In the story that Kleist tells, the sight of the puppets evokes in the watcher not a sense of mechanical automatism, but the impression that the puppets are moving more spontaneously and in a paradoxical sense more freely than human beings do when they act. And as the story that Kleist tells unfolds, the reason seems to be that the puppets are not weighed down by gravity. They almost float, performing their various actions, above the earth. And my interpretation is that gravity really means in this story the burden of choice. The reason that the puppets can float is that they're not burdened by the necessity to choose what they do. The reason humans, from the point of view of Kleist's narrator in the story, are jerky and stuttering in their movements and constantly on the brink of falling down or actually falling down is that they need to decide what to do. They need to choose their actions. So there's a very paradoxical conception of freedom being invoked in this story, which is that freedom might not mean what we all nowadays think it must mean, which is freedom to choose. The type of freedom that Kleist recognizes in the puppets, the marionettes, is freedom from choice.
It is paradoxical, isn't it? It's not the way we're used to thinking about freedom, because there are other ways of achieving freedom from the burden of decision-making, aren't there? There's suicide, which Kleist chose himself, and there's slavery or there's imprisonment. So what kind of freedom is this, really?
Well, the freedom from choice to which Kleist refers isn't a kind of freedom which is achieved by getting someone else, like a tyrannical government, to shut off your freedom. It's not an external type of freedom at all. It's an inner type of freedom, and it's a type of freedom that was promoted in the ancient world and which has been recurrently promoted even in modern times by the ancient religion of Gnosticism, which held that if human beings really understood their situation in the world, really understood themselves, they would become inwardly free, whatever happened to them in the world. So that it's not that they would need to live under a tyranny to have this freedom of choice. They would have this freedom of choice, whatever regime they lived under. And in a way, what my book is to explore that view, which I actually don't accept. I'm critical of that view. I actually reject that view myself, because the type of freedom that these Gnostics and their modern successors, many of whom would deny that they were influenced by any type of religion, many of them would say that they were scientific thinkers, the type of freedom that this involves is a freedom given by knowledge. In other words, the basic idea of Gnosticism is that what makes human beings free, whether it be this inward freedom that Kleist says the puppets have, or a freedom to control the world, freedom to become masters of the earth, is a special type of knowledge. Now, this is probably the dominant belief in the modern world and at the present time. Practically everyone believes that knowledge is liberating. I don't believe that, and I'm closer in my thinking to the biblical Genesis myth, which is discussed towards the end of Kleist's story, which says that, as I interpret it, knowledge is not inherently liberating, it can be enslaving, it's inherently just knowledge. If we think we can obtain salvation or freedom through knowledge, we're mistaken. And what we gain through knowledge is greater power. But how we use that power, whether we use it to free ourselves or enslave others, or is up to us.
Can we sniff out the Gnostics a bit further?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
The Gnostics would have said that Adam and Eve were quite right to eat that apple,
yes,
and that the world,
yes,
as we know it is not the work of God, but some other lesser being, a,
yes,
demiurge.
Yes, yes. The Gnostics were a movement in the ancient world which has had many rebirths in later times, including at the present time, according to which, I mean, they really had two central beliefs. The first is that human beings are spirits or minds imprisoned in their fleshly bodies. That was their first belief. So what's essential about human beings isn't their biological organism, it isn't the fact that they're mortal, it isn't the fact that they have the bodies they do, it's that they are sparks of spirit imprisoned in their bodies, and not only in their bodies, but in matter. Because in the Gnostic worldview, the material universe is a kind of prison. It's something dark, it's not beautiful, it's not our home. We're imprisoned in it. We've somehow fallen into it. And the second belief that Gnostics of all different kinds and streams, there have been Christian Gnostics, Jewish Gnostics, Buddhist Gnostics, Islamic Gnostics, and I would say modern scientific and atheist Gnostics. The second belief is that the way for human beings, these sparks of consciousness or spirit, to escape their enslavement is by the possession of a particular special kind of knowledge, which in the ancient world was identified with a kind of mystical insight into the nature of things achieved through meditation and prayer and fasting. And in the modern world, it has often been identified with science.
It's very interesting, this idea that somehow there can be traces of this religious school of thought in contemporary thinking, even in thinkers who might not recognise or acknowledge that.
Or
but,
even deny it.
Yeah, but are those traces, or traces of some other ideas of similar vintage, visible in your work? I mean, the suggestion that it's foolish to believe in the explicable nature of the universe. That has the shape of a religious idea,
doesn't
it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I'm more influenced partly by poetry. For example, in the very last part of my book, I suggest that inner freedom may be the most valuable form of freedom, but it's not the freedom we achieve through acquiring any special kind of knowledge. It's the freedom we can perhaps achieve by embracing what Keats called negative capability. That's to say, as you'll recall, in a famous letter of his, he referred to negative capability as the capacity to live in doubts and mysteries and uncertainties without the irritable itch for fact or certainty.
Let's bring a bit of violence into this,
yes,
conversation. Not unknown in the puppet world,
no,
thanks to Mr. Punch and Emu and Sooty turning that water pistol on Harry Corbett.
Quite.
When you consider the idea of the constant presence of violence in,
yes,
human history and culture, you use Aztec society,
I do, yes,
as a kind of a model when it comes to finding a place to acknowledge that that quality is always there, that phenomena is always there. What can we really know about the place of violence in Aztec culture? Because as you paint the portrait of it, you do acknowledge that there's an awful lot of uncertainty about this, and an awful lot of interpretations of the role of violence in Aztec culture have fallen by the wayside, haven't they?
Certainly, but I invoke the Aztecs not as a model to be adopted, but partly because they're so different from us. But they're human. They were human beings. They developed this culture by themselves until it was destroyed by the Spanish conquistadors. It was an autonomous set of communities living together, which we broadly call Aztecs. And it's so different in so many ways, especially in the rituals with which it's surrounded violence, including the supreme violence of human sacrifice, that it seems utterly alien to us, but I don't think it is. We can't be certain why they did what they did. But one interpretation which has been proposed by a great scholar of the Aztecs who reads their script and has investigated them profoundly, a scholar called Inga Clendinnen, is one to which I'm attracted, which is that they found in these practices of ritual violence, not what the Romans found. The Romans also engaged in spectatorial violence, in violence as a spectacle, but for them it was mere entertainment. Equally alien from us, I think, in many ways, but it was just entertainment. For the Aztecs, it was a way of imposing or making meaning in the world. Because one of the speculations I suggest is that if it's true that humans differ from other animals primarily, as I'm not proposing it as a scientific theory, but it seems to me quite a plausible and compelling, or at least intriguing, suggestion. If humans differ from other animals primarily in a clearer awareness of their mortality, of the fact that whatever they do, they're going to die, they're going to disappear from the world, then one of the features that humans have, which no other animal appears to have, is the willingness to kill and to die in order to secure a meaning in their lives. In other words, one of the functions of human violence, which was illustrated in the Aztecs, is that not only is violence used for purposes of tyranny and oppression and also for purposes of rebellion and revolution, not only is it used to secure resources and to protect advantages or to assert ideas of justice, that one of the central roles of violence in human life, which is not seen in any other animal, is the use of violence to secure a meaning in life. And I argue that this is one of the aspects of human beings that the great Hobbes, the great political philosopher, English political philosopher in the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes, who I revere in many ways, got wrong, because in his official way of thinking, he said that the worst thing for any human being, the thing that human beings avoid at all costs, is a violent death. And I think that's just obviously clearly not true, because many people have been and are willing to seek out a violent death if it makes their life meaning. Human beings fear more than the loss of life, the loss of meaning. And so they turn to violence. This is one of the reasons, as I've said, not the only reason, but it's one of the functions of violence in human life. And unless we understand that, we won't understand why humans are as violent as they are, and they are pretty violent by compared with most other primates.
If we accept that violence is a basic human trait, as the Aztecs seem to have done, and I think your argument is that violent death was just simply part of the rhythm of their culture and society, does that mean that, I mean, you say it shouldn't be adopted as a model, but I do sense a little bit of envy for what you perceived as the lack of illusion in the Aztec way of life.
When I wrote this, I was certain that people would say, so he wants us to become Aztecs. It's a silly reaction, obviously, but probably inevitable. In the book, what I say is that, of course, any way of life founded on human sacrifice is barbaric, is barbarous, is not civilized, and therefore can't be a model. The interesting thing, though, is that in the 20th century, and I would say at least since the French Revolution, there have been many who've been prepared to sacrifice enormous numbers of human beings in revolutions and wars for the sake of a future generation that would live in freedom. Going back to the Jacobins and before the Jacobins, various millenarian religious cults in modern times, the Bolsheviks, Mao, and I would say also those who propose unending wars to promote democracy, have been ready to inflict appalling violence, typically leads to absolutely nothing. It simply leads to chaos and bloodshed and innumerable broken lives for the sake of a future generation. So although we think that we're radically different from the Aztecs, modern life exhibits what the poet and philologist and essayist Leopardi, the early 19th century writer, called the barbarism of reason, which is the sacrifice of entire generations for the sake of a world which is entirely hypothetical and indeed mythical. So I use the Aztecs, who seem so alien, as a mirror. We're more like them than we think we are already. Again, adamantly denied nowadays because what practically everyone now thinks, which no one thought, I would say, even 50 years ago, or hardly anyone, is that all human beings are essentially peaceful, loving, and only become different because of some kind of oppression. If you go back even to the liberal thinkers of an earlier period, including people like Isaiah Berlin or before that, no one believed that. But nowadays, everyone believes that. And I think that's just a childish myth.
There's an image that rises late in the book when you consider the surveillance culture that we're creating, either CCTV
have
surveillance carried out by, yes, indeed, carried out by governments or companies, and the self-surveillance that arises from social media.
Yes.
Now, for you, this is the realisation of an idea that's been very promiscuous in the history of thought since Bentham thought it up at the end of the 18th century. The panopticon,
yes,
the prison built for surveillance. What concerns you about this, and where do you situate it?
Well, my chief concern is not so much that this is a profound invasion of privacy, but that it is a type of panopticon that a great many people won't want to leave. And it goes along with the creation of a virtual world, a world of images and of celebrity, but also sometimes of spectacular horror, that for many people is preferable to the actual world. I mean, younger people, probably under 20 or even under 30, haven't lived in a world which isn't mediated through to them through this world of images. So I think the really interesting question is not how do we get out of it, but do a great many people want to get out of it? I'm not sure they do. This surveillance society is not something which is simply imposed upon a freedom-loving population which resents it. It has evolved and emerged in accordance with other changes in society and in accordance with new technologies and also in accordance with ideas like Bentham's idea of panopticon that have been around for quite a long time.
Could inner freedom exist in the panopticon? Would the panopticon discourage or encourage it?
For humans, freedom goes along with stumbling, falling down, and falling, and freedom goes along even with the illusion of choice. Freedom means acting in ignorance, in unknowing. Freedom means acting in negative capability, as the poet Keats called it, not knowing the long-term consequences of your actions. You can try and work it out. You have a responsibility not to act capriciously or without thinking about the consequences, but you can't really know. You're surrounded by unknowing, by mystery. That's what freedom is. Now, can there be freedom within the panopticon? In one sense, yes, in another sense, no. Yes, in the sense that if you're stuck in the panopticon, which in a sense we all are now, we can have a kind of freedom if we realise that this is a world of images, a spectacle created, a shifting spectacle, which actually doesn't have very much to do with the underlying realities, because the underlying realities are still there. Let me give you an example. When we see in wars, we see images of old people living in Ukraine or in Syria or in other parts of the world, frail old people are living in basements as the war goes on around them. Their houses have been bombed out. The reality is, the really painful reality, which we resist thinking about, is that in one or two winters' time, they won't be there. They'll probably have perished if the war carries on. So underneath these glittering images, there is a reality which isn't always bad. Sometimes it's good because there can be acts of human kindness, there can be moments of beauty, but there is an underlying reality, and if we retain that sense even if we can't know what that reality is, even if all we have are occasional elusive glimpses or intimations of it, which is, I think, all we can have actually, it's still there. So in that sense, yes, we can have the inner freedom of negative capability, as Keats called it, even within the panopticon. But if we identify with this world of imagery, if we take that virtual world to be the world that actually exists, or that we prefer to live in, we prefer not to think outside of it, we prefer to remain in that world, then of course we can't have any kind of inner freedom at all.
John Gray, and The Soul of the Marionette, A Short Enquiry into Human Freedom, is out now.
Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Canceler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Canceler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler. Featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much.